pee. I see a legal car service company.
The podcast. Partners in Cars podcasts are an informal discussion between two cars colleagues of many years' acquaintance, no part of which can or should be taken as advice or substitute for your own good judgment, having regard to the specifics of any matter you're dealing with. Hello and welcome everybody to the Partners in Cost podcast. My name is Dominic Woodhouse, advocate and national training manager at Partners in Costs, and I'm joined again by Lee Dixon, intrepid explorer of the mountains, valleys and hinterlands of the cost landscape, cost draftsman without equal, legal cost service manager and all-round great guy.
Bonjour. I'm going through a French phase. My kids are learning French, but the only words I can remember, I don't know what this says about me, are Le Bonc and Le Piscine.
I also know some equally childish foreign language.
Childish? The bank and the swimming pool. I don't know what you're talking about.
Well, actually, I want to roll back from that. I was thinking about phrases that I learnt from the film Killing Zoe. None of them good and non-repeatable during this family-friendly podcast.
Yep, let's move along.
We have just been talking about something else. We've mentioned that we've known each other for 21 years ago. You trained me originally in relation to costs. That made me reflect on the fact that we all stand on the shoulders of giants. And with giants in mind, we do intend to at least try and continue our special segment on words of wisdom from wrestlers from the 80s and 90s, which we'll come back to at the end. I had hoped to use the words of Andre the Giant, but unfortunately most of the quotes that I could find from Andre the Giant were a little bit depressing, mostly centred around his inability as a very large person to engage in a comfortable way with the diminutive objects and people they found around him. And generally children find him quite frightening. But we'll come back to some more inspirational words at the end. What is it that we're talking about today?
Well, today we're going to take a run through indemnity cost orders. So before you switch off or black out, we're going to have a quick look at whether they are largely worthless or whether they remain something that you should strive for. How do you obtain an indemnity cost order? Or what do you need to do or not do? And I can't see the bottom of my screen.
Well, it's while you're finding the bottom of your screen, it's an interesting question because I suppose indemnity cost orders, they loom large in our imagination, often suggested to be a particularly important matter, huge importance. And on that basis, similar to Andre the Giant, build within the kayfabe of professional wrestling as a mighty 7'4". His passport actually said 7'2". Sometimes things aren't quite as large and intimidating and imposing as we think they are. And I think that's what we find with indemnity costs orders as well.
Let's go to the very beginning. Basis of assessment. Don't switch off yet. CBR 44.3 is quite clear. You have two basis of assessment. Standard basis, which we touched on previously, indemnity basis, which essentially disapplies proportionality and shifts the burden of doubt. They're the two primary ramifications of an indemnity basis cost order, although the CBR does quite clearly state the court will not in either case allow costs which have been unreasonably incurred or are unreasonable in amount, which is probably the hook on which I intend to hang my argument that indemnity cost orders aren't worth the paper they're written on.
An interesting perspective. So, as you say, common to both is the need for cost to be reasonably incurred and reasonable in amount. Most assessments, I think, will be conducted in a way where reasonableness is usually the primary factor of what dictates how much costs are allowed. How frequently do we even see indemnity cost orders?
Oh, I would say in the last decade, I can remember two.
And I think I can probably remember a few more than that, but not necessarily so many more. They are fairly infrequent. Where do we actually get indemnity cost orders from? We've got Part 36, If you make a Part 36 offer which claimant proceeds to trial and obtains a judgment at least as advantageous as that offer, then ordinarily indemnity costs are going to follow from that. So I think we've probably seen a reasonable amount of bills of cost drawn on an indemnity basis following a successful Part 36 offer. That seems to be, I think, the more common situation where we get orders of this kind. Indemnity cost orders, though, also can come about as a result simply of the court exercising its discretion and deciding to make an order on the indemnity basis. How difficult do you think those powers are to engage? Absent Part 36, the shall order unless unjust to do so provisions, absent those Part 36 considerations, how difficult do you think it is to get an indemnity cost order?
It's a little bit like proportionality. Nobody could really drill down into what proportionality is, but you'll know it when you see it. And it's similar in an indemnity basis. You know, are you entitled to an indemnity basis cost order? You'll know it when you see it, because it's usually an obvious conduct point. Now, obviously, there's various cases touching on this. It has to be out of the norm, essentially. But because this podcast isn't really focused on going into the law and case law in any huge detail, my answer to that question would be, if your opponent has conducted themselves in a manner that is obviously open to criticism, then you are entitled to an indemnity cost order. Similarly, if you reciprocated that, you are probably going to unravel any attempt to get an indemnity cost order. A plague on both your houses.
Yeah, if our listener could just bear with us while we lay out some of the groundwork which enables us to get to the real meat of in what situations we think indemnity cost orders are valuable and in what situations they're not going to be particularly effective. Good point to recognise that back in 2002, Court of Appeal in the case of Excelsior against Salisbury, Hammer, Aspenden and Johnson indicated that there has to be some conduct or circumstance which takes the case out of the norm. So that's really, really what they're looking for, a critical point that there is some conduct of the action or circumstance of that case which generally takes the case out of the norm, which justifies an order for indemnity costs, because it is still just it's a discretionary matter. As you say, we don't labour through long-winded references to case law, but at this point again, 2006 High Court decision in Balmoral Group against Borealis, which I'll read from. It's one of 2 points that I intend to read from today, but where the court stated the discretion is a wide one to be determined in the light of all the circumstances of the case. To award costs against an unsuccessful party on an indemnity scale is a departure from the norm. There must therefore be something, whether it be the conduct of the claimant or the circumstance of the case, which takes the case outside the norm. It's not necessary that the claimant should be guilty of dishonesty or moral blame, unreasonableness in the conduct of the proceedings, and the raising of particular allegations or in the manner of raising them may suffice. So may the pursuit of a speculative claim involving a high risk of failure, or the making of allegations of dishonesty that turn out to be misconceived, or the conduct of an extensive publicity campaign designed to drive the other party to settlement. The marking of a grossly exaggerated claim may also be ground for indemnity costs. So lots and lots of things may take the case outside the norm and justify an indemnity costs order, quite usually going to be a relatively high burden or high barrier and hurdle to overcome.
So the prevailing conclusion is, whilst there are several Orbiton reasons that we haven't touched on, contractual reasons and whatnot, ultimately it comes down to conduct. And if you want to know, am I at risk of an indemnity costs order? I think it's common sense. Have I abused some sort of court procedure? Have I raised completely meritless arguments? Or have I chucked in piles and piles of evidence that nobody needed? Basically, conduct. Not quite to the extreme that we're looking at wasted costs, but ultimately, it does seem to me that you should know if indemnity costs are going to bite. It should be reasonably obvious.
Yeah, you should be able to see that headlight coming through the tunnel. Useful to point out that unless you've got an order that says indemnity costs, then assuming that we're not talking about a solicitor and client assessment under CPR 46, which will be dealt with on an indemnity basis, or there's some other reason why there's a contractual provision for indemnity costs where there's a contractual assessment, then any order will be otherwise on the basis of standard basis cost. So indemnity cost basis, you have to have a specific order that says that, otherwise it's going to be standard basis costs.
Yeah, but ultimately, to come back, to spin round back to the original point, who cares? I mean, what do you get? So you get to disapply proportionality. Okay, right, what is proportionality? Who knows? There's multiple judgments on this. Many fantastic articles on the internet by many very, very experienced barristers, solicitors and cost lawyers, and many people have commented on it. But ultimately, what is proportionality? Who knows? How do you apply it? Who knows? It's incredibly difficult. So it disapplies something that nobody can really apply, save in extremes. You know, you've racked up £150,000 to recover £5,000, you're going to have a proportionality issue there, more often than not. But 99% of the time, it's an incredibly difficult thing to convert to pounds and pence when it comes to establishing an outcome. So if you lose proportionality as a viable issue, does it really impact costs? Or am I naively taking a position that I'm going to lose? I mean, I suppose you're going to jump, Dom, straight away and say, budging.
I would. That would be definitely something we could leap to. In the context of budgeting, we know that if you've got an approved budget, unless there's good reason to do so, the court isn't going to depart from that budget, and it's going to fix the amount of cost that you're going to get. If you get an indemnity costs order, then you are released from the strictures of that budget. That budget, theoretically, that budget has been set on the basis of what was proportionate. Proportionality is no longer in play on the basis of an indemnity costs order, therefore your budget kind of goes out of the window. That was confirmed in Denton against White in the Court of Appeal back in 2014. Is that always going to be a good thing, though?
No. Well, in my opinion, strictly my opinion, no, because one of the beauties of the Harrison judgment is if you're in budget, as a general principle, you'll get paid. So if you're in budget and you're thinking, I'm probably going to get paid, why would you ever want to disapply the budget and open up everything to assessment?
I definitely think it's something that people ought to think really carefully about. The usual assumption is that indemnity cost order is going to mean that you get lots more in costs, but that might not be the case. If, as you say, if you've stayed within budget, then you prefer just to have those budgeted costs. There'll be those cases, and we've seen it quite a few times, where we are over budget, we've got an indemnity costs order and we're over budget, and therefore we think we can get all those additional costs in excess of the budget. In that situation, though, then the court has to make some kind of assessment of those costs. If you're not very greatly over budget, the likelihood is, having been freed from the need to just allow the budgeted costs, the court then makes an assessment of those costs and ends up reducing them to less than the budget actually was. That's a real danger. I think people have to think really carefully about whether they want to run that type of argument or just simply say, we'll take the budgeted amount. There will be those cases where you've got a huge overspend over a budget. In that instance, it might mean that getting an indemnity costs order does enable you to get more back than the budget might have allowed. There might be different ways and better ways of approaching that, though. For instance, you might be better served by being able to identify things that perhaps justified the indemnity cost order and saying that they are things that stand outside the budget, so that the budget can be preserved and the court just make additional allowances for those extra costs.
I'd tread carefully there, because what we don't want to do is spiral down into an argument about how does a court assess overspend on budgets. It's a rabbit hole we don't want to go down, at least not today. It reminds me, many years ago, probably when I was a trainee, I had a conversation with a very senior partner, and it's coming back now. This is genuinely spontaneous. He had an indemnity costs order, and I remember him ringing me up and telling me that I could ignore his retainer. and I could put on any raid I wanted because he had an indemnity cost order. Now, I was very naive and young, and I didn't question that. It didn't seem right. But I remember him specifically saying I want £400 an hour. Now, this was in sort of 2000. Yeah, 2000. And I remember thinking at the time, that can't be right. He was adamant that indemnity costs orders meant you're free to do what you want. You know, full on soup dragons. I'm free to do what I want and how I want to do it. But I think it's maybe important to point out, if anybody thought indemnity costs freed you to do what you want to do, then that's not true at all. You know, you don't get to ignore your retainers. You don't get to, you know, do anything because you're ultimately bound by reasonableness in the normal way. So,
and contractually still for your own client, like you say, for the indemnity principle.
But I always remember that lawyer ringing me up, and I wouldn't say he berated me, but he definitely told me what to do. Just a little bit of flashback there to my younger days. I suppose once we've dealt with proportionality in a very haphazard fashion, the other benefit is the shifting of doubt. So I've always taken the view...
benefit of the benefit of the doubt.
Yeah. See, to me, again, to throw out a vaguely formed anecdote from the past, I either remember somebody telling me, or it may have been at an ACL training conference many, many, many years ago, somebody saying that the burden of doubt was pointless because judges don't have doubt. Now, we briefly spoke previously about the power of doubt in the context of time recording and how your opponent needs to raise doubt, and if it's quite easy for them to create doubt. But when we're talking about the basis of assessment, it moves the burden from the paying party to the receiving party. But ultimately, in practical terms, if you still have that test of reasonableness bubbling away, does it make any difference?
I think we come on to situations where it potentially does make a difference in terms of application of indemnity costs. For the benefit of the doubt point, I've had it said to me many times by judges when they're assessing items of cost that doubt hasn't really come into it. They've looked at an item of costs. They just believe it's unreasonable. It's not because they're in two minds as to whether it's unreasonable or not. They just think it's unreasonable. And on the basis they think it's unreasonable, they replace that figure of costs with a reasonable amount, something that they do consider to be reasonable. So, yeah, entirely agree. I'm not sure that doubt as such comes into an assessment that frequently, other than the occasions when judges simply use it as the get-out-of-jail-free card to be able to say, well, it's standard-based assessment, benefit of doubt goes in favour of the paying party. So it can be used by some judges as the stick to hit you with, but most of the time that's just an additional justification where the primary point is simply they've looked at an item of costs, they think it's too high, so they reduce it, and that benefit of the doubt issue doesn't really come into it with any particular force.
Certainly, if you get an indemnity costs order, more often than not, I mean, as I said, I've maybe seen two. And moving away from indemnity costs on the costs, which is a slightly different thing, that's much more common if you're making decent pot 36s, mainly because assessments are more common than trials. If you're only getting indemnity costs for a very small section of your case, and that means the benefits, as they are, potentially only apply to a very small section of your costs.
You could have made really early Part 36 offers. There might be ways in which, particularly the conduct-based arguments about indemnity costs, I suppose, are more likely to give rise to an order that covers a greater period of time. You know, the entire conduct of the action may become subject to an indemnity costs order. Just in terms of practice, though, I remember under the pre-2013 rules on proportionality, we know that we had the Home Office and Lounge necessity test. I can think, we're sat here now today in Doncaster. I can think of a hearing in Doncaster Court quite some years ago where the judge said, just in relation to necessity, I don't really understand the difference between the two things. If I think something was necessary, I'm going to think it's reasonable. If I think that something was reasonable to do and undertake, then I'm probably going to think that that was something that was necessary for you to do.
I do remember one of our local solicitors, a few years ago now, looking at applying for an indemnity costs order, following a late acceptance of Apart 36 offer. Now, you remember that all was put to bed a while back. And one of the key issues there was, what's the point? You know, what's, when you weighed up the cost of the application, what would you actually gain? The Part 36 had been accepted out of time, but right at the end of the case. So the likely award of indemnity costs was only going to be for a tiny fraction of the work. So ultimately, what was the point? Now, yeah, like you said, I suppose, in a situation whereby you get indemnity costs for a huge chunk of the time, I get it. But I still can't shake the feeling that ultimately the benefit is negligible.
There are some occasions where the indemnity costs might be of more benefit to you, and you might be able to use it to your advantage, and other occasions where it's going to be of much less use to you. And I think we talked about budgets. We'll talk about fixed costs in a moment because they're slightly different things. But whether or not it's going to be of greater or lesser benefit to you, I think depends on the form of assessment. If we're dealing with a detailed assessment, and this is a point where I read a quote from a case dealt with by Cost Judge Brown in the SCCO in 2021, BCX against DTA. He's dealing with a solicitor known client assessment, which is therefore going to be on the indemnity basis per CPR 46.9. And I think this is really illustrative of the difficulties and the point that I'm trying to make. He says in BCX, matters set out in Rule 46.9 in relation to indemnity costs are merely presumptions. Plainly, despite the different bases of assessment, the presumptions will not necessarily lead to any greater sum being payable than would be the case on standard base assessment. This is plainly so, since the very concerns which give rise to disallowance of costs into parties can also give rise to deductions from claim under an assessment on the indemnity basis. And we know that in BCX, charged with the need to approve inter-parties compromise of costs for a protected party, he decides that he has to make an assessment of any shortfall payable by the client, ultimately decides that he would have actually allowed against the client, in all likelihood, less than was actually recovered between the parties. So in that instance, indemnity costs orders make no difference whatsoever to the receiving party's solicitors in that matter. Because again, it's that detailed assessment. We come back to what we've already said about doubt, whether there is any element of doubt at all, where the primary factor is usually reasonableness rather than proportionality. So on a detailed assessment, I think the impact of indemnity costs order is going to be very limited indeed. And there's a definite argument and a reasonable basis for arguing that you would have exactly the same outcome on an inter-parties indemnity costs assessment as you would have done on the standard basis. Where I think it can be more useful are those occasions when you can get the court to paint with a much broader brush. Detailed assessment, they're going to look at all those notes anyway, they're going to consider each and every item, and they'll apply their mind to whether it's reasonable or not. Taking on board what we've already said about just looking at something and thinking, well, it's too high, therefore I replace it with something lower that I think is reasonable. If it comes to summary assessment, in that context, you may be able to get more mileage out of it because you can simply advocate to the judge that there's supposed to be a difference between those two assessments. The common wisdom suggests that indemnity basis is supposed to be more generous. You can put it to judges in that way. Some judges will be receptive to the idea that indemnity basis costs should simply be more generous. So in a summary assessment context, you might actually be able to use it just as a real painting in really broad strokes, and it might mean that you ultimately get more in costs than you would otherwise have done. Do you in practice? Who knows? Because to actually know that for certain, you'd have to get that same judge to do the same same assessment on a standard basis.
Bearing in mind that hidden somewhere under a desk is a book called The Dark Legal 500. And in there, it lists the 500 worst advocates. And I am number 2 on that list. Therefore, my ignorance is matched only by my incompetence when it comes to advocacy. I probably don't share your optimism in respect of provisional assessments. Are we talking about summary assessments or provisional assessments?
Summary assessments.
Right. So applying that same principle to provisional assessments, because they're not a million miles apart from each other, and bearing in mind I've just proven my point about my complete incompetence, would you say, Dom, that the principles you've just said there in respect of summary assessment are the same on a provisional assessment?
It's a really interesting halfway house. given the limited amount of time that judges have to conduct a detailed assessment, I always thought it was supposed to be like 45 minutes, an hour potentially, that they got set aside.
Did you say detailed or provisional?
But, well, I meant provisional assessment, whichever one I inadvertently said. I meant provisional assessment. They've got a much more limited amount of time, so you could expect that they might paint with that broader brush. So again, giving less consideration to the detail of those costs, they might allow an indemnity basis costs order to just motivate them to be more generous. I suspect, though, in practice, that most, and certainly I think a lot of the provisional assessments that we see aren't conducted on a broad brush basis. They look at each individual entry and they're still doing taking the same approach as they would under detailed assessment. So yes, there seems like there might be an argument to be made that you might get more benefit out of an indemnity basis cost order on a provisional assessment. In practice, I suspect it's very similar to detailed assessment and that you're going to have roughly the same outcome. Again, ignoring these points where we might have been released from a budget, and as we'll come on to, where you might be able to escape fixed costs.
I think, and treading very carefully with what I say here, bearing in mind all the provisional assessments I've seen since that system was introduced, I'd have very little confidence that that many judges would really pay that much attention. But that's a whole different argument, provisional assessments and the casino that they are. So I suppose, as you've just teased there then, fixed costs. Now, fixed costs and indemnity basis costs. Where do we go from there?
Well, straight away we have to talk about dates. We know that we've had a new fixed cost regime, expanded, updated and invigorated from the 1st of October 2023. So if we put that to one side for a moment, if we're talking about the pre-1st of October 2023 fixed cost regime, then we know that if you get an indemnity cost order for a period, that releases you from fixed costs. You get your time basis multiplied by an hourly rate for the period after your indemnity cost order kicks in. So that can be really useful. Again, we're always working under the assumption that normal standard basis hourly rate multiplied by time spent costs are going to be more than fixed costs. So in that context, it could be really valuable to you and you could get more money as a result. So that's an instance in which indemnity basis cost orders can pay off. Again, every reason for making those early Part 36 offers that are really going to bite when it gets into the later stages of the claim. Under the new fixed cost recoverable cost regime, though, it's a slightly different kettle of fish. Post 1st of October, for those cases caught by the new regime, we've got different provisions in relation to Part 36. So we know that, for instance, if you are a claimant and you make a Part 36 offer which is not beaten at trial by your opponent, so you obtain something which is at least as advantageous as at trial, then instead of the current provisions where you get indemnity basis costs order, an additional amount is 10% of the judgment sum and so on, instead of all that, you will instead get an additional 35% of the difference between the fixed costs from the time at which you made that offer and ultimately disposed of at trial. So you're just getting an increase of those fixed costs. So it doesn't get you out of fixed costs by the Part 36 route. It does leave open the question, and there's a disclaimer at the beginning of this show, this is no more than a discussion between pals. There is a question mark over whether even post October 2023, an indemnity basis costs order specifically made, so not tied to Part 36 because that's out of the window, but an indemnity basis costs order that you've persuaded the court to make on the basis of conduct and its general discretion, whether or not that releases you from fixed costs. Seems like it probably is going to be something that would be much more difficult to engage even then, because we've got the unreasonable behaviour provisions in these new fixed cost rules, so that if a party has behaved unreasonably, then if they're the receiving party, their fixed costs might be reduced by 50%. If the paying party has behaved unreasonably, then their fixed costs that the claimant would be entitled to, or the receiving party, might be increased by 50%. So with those provisions and those conduct provisions essentially already baked into the fixed costs rules. I do wonder how, whether that raises the bar for getting an indemnity costs order in that situation, and whether or not that would release you from fixed costs. To my mind, there's still an argument there, but it sounds like it's probably going to be one that's quite difficult to overcome. Again, though, bear in mind that the new fixed costs are, again, we make assumptions on the basis of calculations that we've done, the files that we see, the clients that we have. We make the assumption that those fixed costs are going to be very much less than what cost would be calculated at time spent multiplied by an hourly rate. So if it was possible to get out of it on the basis of an indemnity basis costs order, then that is likely to be of considerable benefit to you in a fixed cost environment. However, post 1st of October 2023 for this new regime appears to be even more difficult to engage, and still with a question mark over whether it can release you from fixed costs at all.
Complicated stuff, fixed costs. I think I'm going to just wrap this up with a quote that I'm going to steal from Cook on Costs. So Cook on Costs, if you're not aware of it, is a long-running seminal tome on costs. But this quote, I think, sums up indemnity costs. What seems clear is the exercise of the discretion by the court is best considered by reference to specific examples of where the court has made indemnity cost orders. It is one of those instances where it is hard to pinpoint specific conduct, but one knows it when one sees it. Which I think takes us full circle back to something I may have said at the beginning, which was, I think we all kind of know if it's going to apply. Whether it's worth it or not, I think you're probably more in the camp that there are definite benefits.
Occasionally.
I am a little bit more cynical. If anybody has any insight or comments on indemnity cost orders, we'd love to hear from you. Please do get in touch.
And that brings us full circle as well, back to this, our special segment devoted to wise words of wrestling stars from the 80s and 90s. As mentioned at the beginning, not sure that this is going to be quite as rich a seam as I originally thought. We've already excluded the words of one of the greats, Andre the Giant. But we can finish with a quote from The Ultimate Warrior, if you remember The Ultimate Warrior.
I do remember The Ultimate Warrior.
Also a giant of the WWF back in its day and into its transition into the WWE. And I'm going to read, again, a quote that he gave back in the day. I think it really speaks to how we all want to leave something behind. We want to be remembered. We want to believe that in some way we live on, and I think that's something that really speaks to us all. So in that way, it's quite powerful. But the Ultimate Warrior said this: every man's heart one day beats its final beat, his lungs breathe a final breath, and if what that man did in his life makes the blood pulse through the body of others and makes them bleed deeper and something larger than life, then his essence, his spirit, will be immortalized. I was going to suggest that if you bleed out something larger than life, then it's difficult to make a case for actually still being alive. And I suppose it is a little bit troubling and difficult that one person's aggrandizement depends on other people bleeding for him or them. And I suppose you could draw a lot of parallels with the greats of the world, again, standing on the shoulders of giants, but in this instance, potentially the smaller of us, the everyday folk. It's also to be remembered that the Ultimate Warrior, as he said elsewhere, said that his spirit will live forever. So he's definitely talking about something more spiritual than I've been talking about here.
I like how you're applying your legal mind to unravel a quote from the Ultimate Warrior.
Well, bear in mind this. The Ultimate Warrior also said that the family that I live for only breathes the air that smells of combat. And I think dealing with costs, is that not just us? We breathe the smell of the air of combat.
The Cost Wars, if anybody remembers them. God.
Tag, claims direct.
Oh, yes.
It was a different time.
Thanks, everybody, for joining us today, as always. We hope you took something away from this adventure through indemnity basis costs. If you want more information or any training on anything we've Morris danced around today, please do contact either myself or Dom. We hope to hear from you. Speaking of which, Morris dancing, I didn't realise that the sticks the Morris dancers wave around are apparently symbolic of weaponry.
I feel like I've heard that before.
But what are the bells on the feet? What's that? Warn your enemies, they're about to batter you with sticks.
Warn off spirits, I suppose, in the same way that Hannibal used to, I think, attach bells and things to the elephants that he sent against the troops just to make them more ferocious, more intimidating than they may otherwise appear to be. So we're back to kayfabe again and wrestling.
There you are. Although I can't imagine you'd need bells strapped to an elephant to make it any more intimidating. Anyway, thanks very much, everybody. Take care. Keep safe. Bye-bye.
Goodbye. and take care of yourselves and each other, and never become mayor of New York, because it doesn't work out well in the end.
Dom's top tip.